Well, this week in Canberra, the parliamentary year came to a close, and it might have been the last time our federal politicians will meet before next year's election. There was the usual rush to pass bills, such as the Magnitsky-style sanctions laws we discussed earlier in the show, and a few retirements as well. But yet again, a lot of the focus was on the culture in the building itself. And in many ways, the sitting year finished as it began, with discussion about sexism and sexual assault in the halls of power, and unanswered questions about whether anything is actually ever going to change. So, as promised last week, the political year that was and the election to come is the topic of our Sunday Extra Roundtable today. And my guests this morning have reported on and studied and observed federal politics for decades. The first is Laura Tingle, 7.30's Chief Political Correspondent. Welcome to Sunday Extra.
Hi, James.
We're also joined by noted columnist Nikki Sava. Thank you for joining us, Nikki.
Thank you.
And Anne Tiernan, a well-regarded political scientist at Griffith University in Queensland.
Hi, James.
It's been quite a year, Laura, and to you first. Will this year be the moment that's remembered as the tipping point, the moment the culture in Canberra shifted?
Certainly the year when the culture in Canberra suddenly became a front and centre issue. And whether it tips into something different, I think, is not entirely clear. I mean, people are looking for reforms to come out of Kate Jenkins, the Sex Discrimination Commissioner's report. But of course, cultural change is about a lot more than that. And one of the things that somebody observed to me through the week was that we obviously have a lot of independents running in next year's election. Most of them are women. If you look at independents who ran 10 years ago, it was mostly blokes, and they were basically former MPs from political parties. And somebody observed through the week to me that one thing that was interesting about what's happened this year is that nobody's likely to go after these candidates over their personal lives. It's going to be very hard to attack women for being women from now on. Now, I just offer that as an observation about the way things have changed, because I remain deeply depressed and cynical about whether a lot of the reforms that need to be changed, which don't necessarily even relate to women, but they relate to things like non-disclosure agreements in contracts, in the way the act that governs ministerial staffers work, all of those things. But I think there has been a cultural shift, even if the Prime Minister remains with an exceptionally bad tin ear on a lot of it.
Nikki, I wanted to bring you in because you wrote this week about how change has to be driven from the top. Do you believe Scott Morrison is actually capable of leading and driving some of that change?
I don't think that we've seen any evidence at all this year that he is capable of that. That's another thing that makes it so dispiriting. For instance, you know, after the Jenkins report came out the other day, his lines, I thought, were, to be honest, pretty pathetic, especially when he was responding to Zali Steggall. Oh, you only just got here, you don't know, but this has been going on for such a long time and everybody's responsible. Well, yes, it has been going on for a long time. Everybody has been responsible, but he is the Prime Minister today and it's up to him to lead, you know, to actually come out and say, this is an intolerable situation that men and women in this building have been subjected to, you know, some pretty awful things, and I am going to do whatever it takes to fix it. We did not hear that. We didn't even hear him say that he was going to accept all the recommendations. So I thought that that was a pretty poor sign, really, that he has not really taken on board the messages that people have been sending him all this year.
Laura mentioned the independents who are running, Nikki, and it's hard to know exactly what their chances are going to be at this stage. But a former leader in Gladys Berejiklian is someone who's often talked about behind the scenes as a potential starter. Do you believe that she actually is seriously going to consider running, given that she has a fairly frosty relationship with Scott Morrison. And do you think that someone like her could make a substantial difference here in Canberra to the culture and the way that government works?
Well, from what I've been told and what I've also written in my column is that she has been approached by Morrison using Josh Frydenberg as a go-between, because the relationship between Morrison and Berejiklian is basically non-existent. And she has told Frydenberg that she is interested in the idea and, you know, she will soon come to a decision on it. Now, that would be a coup in a way, assuming that there is not an adverse finding against her from ICAC. That will be seen as a coup for Morrison, because she is still so incredibly popular amongst Liberal women in particular, and he would be able to say, look, see, I'm not so bad after all. I can still, you know, persuade someone like Gladys Berejiklian to come to Canberra and she will make a difference. And she, I think, would make a difference if she was able to get past all these hurdles and make it into the federal parliament. And her friends tell me that while she's serious about it, because she wants to redeem herself in a way, or to be vindicated by the voters, if you like, they think on balance that she would probably wait until the next election.
Yeah, the timeline is quite tight. Part of the problem in Parliament has always been the power imbalance between an MP and their staff, and the lack in particular of a mechanism to independently deal with any complaints of bad behaviour. And you've studied the conditions under which staff are employed quite extensively, and the infamous MOPS Act. How much of a difference would changing that make to the lot of staff in this building? Or is it something that is kind of more ingrained in the political culture, and that there is sort of a need to be able to quickly hire and fire?
Well, James, I think the MOPS Act hasn't evolved since it was first introduced in 1984. It was really never intended to govern a big group of people. It was always intended that ministerial staff would be, you know, a smallish group comprised of mostly seconded public servants who, of course, would operate within codes of conduct and frameworks and merit selection and a bunch of other sort of things that we take for granted. Politicians, including Scott Morrison, have guarded the MOPS Act very closely. The recent 30 review of the Australian Public Service, we've made a number of recommendations about ministerial staff and trying to bring them into a better framework of accountability, but also a better framework of employment and professional development. And those were rejected by the Prime Minister in, you know, ironically in December 2020, before the allegations of Brittany Higgins kind of broke. So I think the dilemma with the MOPS Act arrangement is that we now have a very significant number of politically partisan appointed people with not necessarily any background or experience doing anything else. They come in and are accountable to and report to only their employer. And it's not only on the ministerial side. The electorate offices, you know, are also a site for some of this ecosystem system that Kate Jenkins has examined. So I think, you know, the cultural issues are partly related to the power imbalance that's entrenched in the fact that the staffers don't really exist. They exist as surrogates of their employers. So I think giving it more systematic status and putting workplace arrangements around it is fine. It doesn't solve the fundamental accountability problem at the heart of it, which is, do they then become part of a framework of integrity and accountability that applies to everybody else? And that's been a, you know, a real black hole for a long time.
Another reoccurring theme of this year has been honesty and integrity. And of course, we've had all sorts of discussions of pretty well documented rorts and some fairly infamous occasions where Scott Morrison was called a liar, including by the French president. All politicians lie, Laura, but in your experience, you've been here a long time now, have you seen a government that has had quite as many questions swirling around its integrity?
No.
That's a very definitive answer.
No. Well, it hasn't. I mean, it has become a defining feature, James, of the government and of the Prime Minister. You know, the issue of whether he tells the truth or not, it's showing up in polling. I mean, I think the Macron intervention really crystallised it. But so many times now, you know, the questions about his policy positions aren't about the fact that he's changed his mind. It's about the fact that he misrepresents what they previously were or misrepresents what they currently are. And that's catching up with him. And, you know, with a background of, as you say, all the noise about rorting of entitlements and grants schemes and the like, it's basically created a really murky sort of fetid atmosphere around the government, which it's very hard for it to climb away from, I think.
Liberal MPs say behind the scenes that, oh, no, we're going to go and have a really nice summer holiday and people are going to travel around, they're going to see their families, it's going to be like before COVID and everyone's going to just forget about this. Do you think that's the case, Laura? Or is it going to follow him into next year?
I think that's really hard to say, James, as a sort of universal proposition. You know, people in electorates that have been really hard hit by lockdowns in Melbourne and, say, Western Sydney, the MPs just say, look, my voters can't afford to go away on holidays. It's going to take them a long time to financially recover from their current situation. People who've sort of, even people who've gone back to work, are not getting full shifts, so they're still struggling to catch up. So I think there's going to be a lot of scarring, not just for employees, but for businesses who are similarly sort of in that state of uncertainty. So while the headline numbers might show a surge of, you know, retail sales or whatever, I think the experience on the ground in very specific geographic locations will be very different.
Nikki, we're just navigating the time of year that's sometimes referred to as the killing season. Perhaps the ABC was partly responsible for kind of spreading that a bit more than it needed to. But in more normal times, do you think that the allegations of lying, the trustworthiness question, which of course has come off the back of a lot of different questions about competency and the vaccine rollout, do you think that that could have led to numbers being counted and rumours of a leadership spill swirling in a different time in Australian history?
I think if not for COVID, I think we would have seen some movement against Morrison. I was talking to people a couple of weeks ago about this, and they were agreeing that if it hadn't been for COVID, he would probably be gone. And if you think back to time before COVID, after the bushfires when he nicked off to Hawaii, he was on a big slide then. It was the bushfires, it was his disappearance, it was I don't hold a hose, mate, it was trying to force people to shake hands with him. Then it was sports rorts, then it was the emergence of other integrity issues as well, and things were building up, right? And he was looking very shaky in the job. And then, lo and behold, the pandemic, he sets up the national cabinet, everybody's working together really well, he re-establishes himself. And then we're not quite back to where we were pre-COVID in terms of Morrison's standing. But it's kind of got that same feel about it where everything he touches seems to turn to custard, really. And the mood in the joint party meeting the other day was described to me as maudlin, right? So they're very unhappy with the way things are going. They are keeping their fingers crossed that things do improve over summer. And maybe if they can narrow the gap and then go to an election early, he can stop being prime minister in effect, and he will be campaigner, and he's very good at that.
We might come back to that in a moment. And you've been writing this week about this last unedifying fortnight, as you called it. What sort of impact do you think the shenanigans you see in Parliament House itself, but also the discussion about lying and integrity, what sort of impact do you think that has in the broader community and the view on politicians and indeed institutions that are critical to our democracy more broadly?
Yeah, I think that's right, James. Even before the Jenkins review came down, the previous week had been pretty untidy. You know, a lot of coalition disunity, you know, of the kind that Nikki and Laura have alluded to. But also there is something in the modus operandi of the Prime Minister and his office in the way they deal with dissidents. So five male coalition members cross the floor and nothing happens. You know, one woman, Bridget Archer, crosses the floor and then the next minute she's being ushered by Josh Frydenberg into a meeting with the Prime Minister. So this is the tin ear kind of problem. So, you know, I think there's a number of sort of optics around the way the government's conducting itself. And fundamentally, it's hard to get past the view that there just isn't an agenda. There is no purpose to the power that's being sought or exercised. And I think that, you know, that really is becoming quite clear. And people like Sam Mostyn for Chief Executive Women, some of the community independents who are stepping forward, who are women, you know, who not only can't be criticised for, you know, their personal lives, but they've actually done something before they came to the parliament. They actually aren't careerists who've kind of come through this system facilitated by the MOPS Act. So I think, you know, how's it playing in the community? Well, I think we've seen a decline in trust quite spectacularly over time, longitudinally. I think how that's going to look in the 2022 Australian election survey might be even worse than the terrible numbers that we saw in 2019. You know, the thing I'm really concerned about is the weaponization of incumbency, which, you know, has followed the government in the early part of the year with all those rorts and grants programs that were revealed from 2019. And now the appointment of everybody's mates has kind of begun ahead of the election. So it's all that stuff adds up to a picture of the public being really cynical. Do they think that all politicians do it? Maybe. Does it have a particular character in the ways that Laura and Nikki have alluded to? Yeah, I think it does. And I think the Prime Minister and, you know, and don't forget Barnaby Joyce is the Deputy Prime Minister. So, and he is a big negative, particularly with women. So I think the woman problem, as well as the integrity problem, is a pretty significant one for the government.
One thing the government likes to trumpet is the way that Australia has made it through the pandemic compared to the rest of the world in terms of deaths and cases of COVID, and of course how much that's down to the states and the premiers, or the Commonwealth is open to a lot of debate, particularly at the moment. But when Australians head to the polls, Laura, how important do you think the pandemic is going to be? Will there be a strong inclination to stick with the status quo, or is the pandemic going to be firmly in the rear vision mirror?
Well, it partly depends, of course, on variants and all those things. Look, I think it will be there, maybe not as something that's either there or in the rear vision mirror, but it's all fed into all of these sorts of things that we've talked about. You know, the fact that the Prime Minister has spent so much of the last 18 months basically in a political battle with the premiers. You know, it started off well. And that's had two implications. One of them is that it hasn't been a Prime Minister versus Leader of the Opposition political discussion for most of that time, which you could say favours the Prime Minister. I mean, all of our conversation so far today has been about the government, because who knows what Labor's doing.
I promise we'll get to it. Yeah, sure. Elbow in a minute.
Sure. But at the same time, a lot of it will depend on people's perceptions of, you know, whether it was the premiers who saved us or made it worse, and once again, how much that reflects back, the extent to which the opposition, now that it is sort of coming back into play, will be able to use that argument that the reason why we had lockdowns, the reason why things went bad again this year, was because we had what has now been officially declared the word of the year, the strollout on vaccines, and whether that affects people's sense of government capability.
What do you think about this, Nikki? Because we've seen in state elections that incumbents do have a fairly substantial advantage. And one of the things that kind of strikes me as you speak to people who are pretty depressed in the Liberal Party at the moment is that they do look at the value that incumbency has provided at other elections and kind of think, well, maybe that is going to be something that rescues us.
I don't think they should count on that. I think people know and understand who has done what during this period. And I think a lot of the credit has to go to the premiers. They have had to make most of the difficult decisions and then to implement them, right? So they have had carriage. And from what I'm told, it has shown up in the research that at critical times, the Prime Minister has been missing. One of the other phrases that I think will be inscribed on Morrison's tombstone is, "This is not a race." And I think what Anne said really resonated with me too. No agenda. There's no purpose other than the pursuit of power.
And that's perfect segueing as well. Thank you, Nikki, because I wanted to ask, and there's been a lot of, you know, there hasn't really been much legislation of note, and certainly not that's been in any sort of public forum. When you look at doing research and you're looking at the electorate, the thing that strikes me at the moment in Australia is that we sort of appear to be a little bit behind some of our Western counterparts, places like the United States and the United Kingdom. Would you expect that this election that could be ripe for a campaign largely fought on cultural grounds, I guess is the best way to describe it, things like school curriculums, funding for the ABC, religious freedoms, debates about Australia Day, things like that?
I think that's where the government would love to have the election fought, and you can see that in the priority of the legislation that it's brought forward in this last 2 weeks. But the things that other people want to talk about are a federal integrity commission, you know, and I think this Commonwealth state dynamic is a really important one, because the other line I think might be inscribed on the Prime Minister's record is Prime Minister for New South Wales. And I think it would be very interesting, actually, if Gladys Berejiklian nominates for Warringah, because I don't know how that would play in Queensland where I live. She's not very popular here. And I don't know how it would play in Victoria either, where some of those questions about federal government priority setting and competence kind of came up. So I think that's really interesting. But the states have also provided all the leadership around climate action. And that's resonating pretty strongly with people as well, and how the transition is going to happen. And the Prime Minister, of course, you know, has to deal with the National Party and with the dissident senators, you know, who mostly come out of here, unfortunately. So, you know, how's that culture war going to play vis-a-vis all those other issues? You know, Laura talked about scarring. I think one of the challenges for the government is really going to be dealing with the many different Australias and the many different experiences of this pandemic. The COVID-free, essentially, states might be right in the middle of something when the election is on. And that's, you know, obviously the concern in, you know, Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia and Tasmania, presumably. But I think there's a lot of uncertainty. But I do think that the legislative choices around, you know, religious discrimination, the moderates have you know, been pushing back on some of that. And it's really hard to see what the forward economic agenda is. So if he decides to do a budget, what's the economic narrative that doesn't include climate action and some of these other, you know, how's the muscular defence policy playing on some of our trade relationships? You know, these are big questions, I think, for the government in framing its campaign pitch beyond the culture issues.
Laura, I promise we'd briefly at least talk about Labor. Anthony Albanese was saying the other night, we're kicking with the wind in the fourth quarter, which is kind of a confusing sort of reference given that he likes rugby league and from New South Wales, but whatever. But it's kind of, I'm still a little sceptical. They're about to release enormous amounts of policy, but I think they will begin campaigning hard. What do you think that the Labor Party is going to do? Are they too scared after the last election that they don't really want to outline too much of an agenda? They just want to keep all the debate on Scott Morrison?
Well, it's funny that he's still using that analogy, because I did an interview with him for 7:30 in January where I said to him, "Well, everybody's saying that you've used this analogy and we're sort of in the fourth quarter, aren't we?" Labor's strategy is basically, and they're saying, look, it's all part of a cunning plan. We always thought that this guy would blow himself up. We wanted to let him do that, and then we would come out and sort of basically sort of not look scary, you know, not really have to say very much. I think there is still that sort of flavour of replaying the last election and the nightmare of too much policy. And I think the classic sort of test of that will be climate policy. And they're having this big jamboree this weekend where they're having a rally and maybe everybody gets a show bag, I don't know. And then Chris Bowen, the climate spokesman, is speaking at the press club on Monday. So they're going to try to finish the year, you know, talking about sort of issues that are of concern to people. There's been a huge push to position Anthony Albanese differently from the Prime Minister. And one of the things that I noticed when I was thinking about my column for last week was all that stuff that Sam Mostyn from Chief Executive Women spoke about how Scott Morrison keeps turning up in high-vis and hard hats when the infrastructure we need is about the care economy. And I think that's a very, very powerful point. And I just thought about it and I thought, you actually don't see Albanese in too many hard hats these days. You know, you see pictures of him at childcare centres and talking to female workers and things. And I think they are therefore pitching to an audience that we don't sort of recognise in the cliches of television media, shall we say. And that's going to be, apart from what they do about policy, whether you can actually
get the vibe across.
get the vibe of the thing across when you're doing that, when the pictures aren't quite as obvious, I think is going to be really interesting.
Nikki, I was interested in your comments before. What do you think that Australians are going to make of Anthony Albanese once he's really under the hammer, under the intense lights of a campaign, and Scott Morrison is, as you say, a very effective campaigner and will be going after him every day?
Well, I think that's the critical issue. I think that Albanese has actually done okay up to this point. If you look at other opposition leaders around the country, I mean, they've been killed off like flies. They've been falling. New Zealand is on its third opposition leader, for instance. So he's hung in there. His numbers are not brilliant, but they're not too bad either. But we don't know what he will be like under the pressure of a 5 or 6 week campaign. He's a variable quality when it comes to interviews. I mean, sometimes you listen and you think, yeah, he nailed that okay. And there are too many times, though, when you listen and you think, what the hell is he saying? What point is he trying to make? Now, he can't afford to have too many days like that or too many interviews like that during the campaign. He has to be sharp, he has to be on point, and he has to speak with authority. So I hope he spends the summer in some sort of coaching holiday camp, you know, or something.
Summer boot camp. He's got to fix that.
summer boot camp, definitely.
And I just wanted to ask you finally, where is Australia at, do you think, in terms of our democracy when you look at the rest of the world? Are we going to have parties and leaders in the future that project big visions for the country, or are they going to be trying to appeal to an increasingly narrow voter base like we've seen in certain other parts of the world?
Well, I think the concern is that they will do that, and that the social cohesion and the trust and the arrangements, you know, the mutual respect for the institutions and conventions of our democracy continue to be eroded, and that will be a very bad thing all round. So I think, you know, the view that our institutions are degraded is widely shared, particularly outside of government, and people are very concerned about that. And I think the focus on integrity and accountability and demands for a federal ICAC, I don't think are going to go away. But I think the tribalism of our politics is really damaging. Our governance in the federal parliament is not commensurate to what's going on in the rest of every other sector of the economy. And I think the risk of lost opportunities and lost prosperity is existential. And I think we actually need to be thinking about this as citizens in the lead up to the election, because I think the triumph of the permanent campaign is just really bad for Australian democracy. And that's the campaign that's going to happen. I think people should really think about where they place their vote with people who aren't going to do that. I think the 2019 election, of course, has, you know, left searing memories with Labor. But, you know, there does need to be a vision for the country, and there does need to be a way of working towards that.
Well, that's all we have time for on our Sunday Extra political panel for today. Thank you so much at the end of what's been a pretty crazy week to Laura Tingle, 7:30's Chief Political Correspondent.
Pleasure, James.
To noted columnist Nikki Sava, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Anne Tiernan from Griffith University, thank you so much for having a chat today.
Thanks a lot, James.